Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are beginning today's show by going to France. Over 170 million people are now locked down across Europe. Following Italy and Spain, on Tuesday, France imposed a nationwide lockdown, banning people from leaving home except to work, receive medical care, or buy food. And the changes are happening very quickly. Today's guest, Paris-based writer Cole Stengler, in the Washington Post writes, authorities are ramping up public intervention in the economy. The French government has unveiled a stimulus plan worth some 45 billion euros, including measures that allow struggling businesses to cancel taxes, social security contributions, and even rent and utility payments. The plan also includes a major expansion in the temporary unemployment system, with the state more than quadrupling the maximum sum it pays employers to keep workers with reduced hours on staff. Journalist Cole Stengler wrote this piece for the Washington Post. It's called "The Pandemic Has Flipped the Logic of Macronism on Its Head," and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. And Cole Stengler joins us from Paris. Hi, Cole. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, according to the latest numbers from Johns Hopkins, there are now 10,891 cases in France. Europe is taking unprecedented steps to contain the spread of the virus. First off, just talk about what this experience has been like for you as a reporter. We are all still in the process of getting used to all of these drastic changes.
Yeah, you know, I on a personal level, I was I'm typically based in Paris and work in Paris, and when I was out in the countryside over the weekend, taking a weekend in the countryside to relax, basically, the first of these confinement measures were announced, and this is before Macron's speech on Monday, introducing these larger confinement measures. But the first measures were announced on I believe last Thursday, where Macron announced the closing of schools and universities. The government called on people to start practicing to keep social distancing in place. And essentially, one of the media outlets I work for told me to basically stay in the countryside, and that's not unlike what a lot of people are hearing about employers telling people not to come to work, employers encouraging people to stay at home and to telecommute, essentially. Télétravail is the word in French, essentially, working remotely. And we've seen that practice really, really spread across the country. That's something that I'm doing. And of course, there's also a whole other swath of workers that can't simply work from home. They actually need to show up, and that's a whole other issue.
And what exactly, we're sort of now just learning the differences between shelter in place and lockdown. What we're dealing with here in California is we are sheltered in place, which means please stay home as much as possible and only go out if you need to go to the grocery store or to the bank. You can go on a walk in the park or on the beach, but just maintain social distancing, 6 feet between you and the next person. I've been reading, though, about France. Every time you leave your home, you have to fill out a form to let authorities know why you are out. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. And, you know, people are starting to kind of learn by experience here to see exactly how authorities are going to be enforcing this. But essentially, that's correct. So as of noon on Tuesday this week, Macron's speech was on Monday night. These new measures took effect Tuesday afternoon, starting at noon. Under these measures, that's correct, you're required to fill out a form in which you have to note the reason you're going to be leaving your home. That can either be for health reasons. It can be for professional reasons. If your employer has not given you the ability to work remotely, and in that case, you need a separate form to show that you have permission from your employer to come into work. And then there is also a category for doing grocery shopping, essential shopping, and then finally a category for doing exercise, for getting some amount of physical activity. And so there was initially some hesitation about whether or not this form could be completed online. People were filling out these forms basically on their phones, And then the government announced that actually you needed to either print out a physical copy of this form or fill it out by hand, write out the whole thing by hand. So I've taken to personally to writing out this form by hand. And that's essentially what everyone's working with here. And if you don't follow these measures, there have been reports of fines that the fines have actually increased now to 135 euros if you're found to be in violation of these new confinement measures.
Wow. And according to reports, the reason why these extreme measures are being taken is because things are moving so quickly there. Yesterday, Al Jazeera reported that France reported 108 more deaths just yesterday, lifting the toll to 372. The country is witnessing an almost 40% increase in cases and deaths every year. President Macron says that France is only at the beginning of the coronavirus crisis and is in a race to curb its progress. Tell us about how it has unraveled in France.
Yeah, I think this crisis came very suddenly, or at least was felt very suddenly by most people, not unlike what I think Americans are experiencing right now. There were reports, obviously, of what was going on in China, in the Hubei province, in Wuhan, but that seemed sort of far away. And we saw cases start to spread worldwide in Iran. And then the first cases that were reported in France and Italy, and things have really, it's really hard to believe that the last couple weeks have passed so quickly. 10 days ago, a week ago, even, people are out in Paris as if everything was normal. And clearly the government started to take it more and more seriously, both the risk posed by the coronavirus and then the measures that needed to be taken. And, the measures that Emmanuel Macron has taken and the tone that the president has adopted in defending his policy, I think in large part has been informed by the experiences of other countries that have fought the coronavirus, namely China. And if you look at the tone that Emmanuel Macron has taken in defending these measures, the speech that he gave on Monday night.
Did we lose you?
Tuesday was a very somber. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. You just cut out there, but you're back. Go ahead.
Sorry, the tone that Emmanuel Macron, the president, I was saying, took when he gave the speech introducing these confinement measures that took effect on Tuesday, his tone was very somber. He said France was at war multiple times was the phrase that he used, France being at war. And so the government has really dramatically shifted in tone, and the atmosphere has changed really quickly, both in the country, but also just the discourse of the state. And I think it's probably not unlike what the path that a lot of jurisdictions in the U.S. and states in the U.S. are taking right now.
What has been the response from citizens now that there is a strict lockdown in France? What are you hearing?
Well, I think everything is relative in how you judge the response. It seems like when the first speech was given by Macron last Thursday, encouraging people to keep social distancing, encouraging people to take this threat seriously, that weekend, so last weekend, people showed up at parks across the country. In Paris, there were photos circulating of people congregating together in parks, and that seemed to show that people weren't taking it all that seriously. That was last weekend, and really since the new measures have taken place, there's been a shift. If you look at images of Paris, images of major cities, the streets are eerily deserted, so it does seem to be taken more seriously. At the same time, there has been a number of fines that have been handed out, and the government's really starting to try to enforce this a bit more. So there has been a change since the confinement measures have taken effect on Tuesday afternoon.
And I'm sure that you have been following what's going on here in the United States. I mean, over the past 2.5 weeks, we've been doing shows about how hospitals are completely overwhelmed. Our hospitals here have a major shortage of ventilators and masks. The swabs are running out. Doctors and nurses and frontline workers are taking to social media to share stories. We're now hearing that healthcare workers are being advised to use bandanas because there are not any more masks. Yesterday, we did a show about a very low rate of testing happening in the United States. We're now hearing that, you know, if you get sick, please self-isolate. We need the tests for the frontline workers. What is the situation like in France when it comes to hospitals, the gear that they need, and testing?
No, I mean, those are all really important questions. And while I can't give you fully informed answers with the data, I'll just give you a few anecdotes to maybe start to answer that question. I think the French health system is more equipped to handle patients in the sense that it's easier to get healthcare in France. Even if testing is ultimately free in the United States, there are still costs associated with being treated in France. You don't have that, so that is a big difference. At the same time, I don't think we ought to romanticize the French system too much either. France is dealing with already before this crisis broke out, decline in hospital beds that were available, and we're starting to see that borne out right now with hospitals starting to have huge influx of patients. And just anecdotally, again, this question about testing. Germany, it seems like, has been able to provide more testing to those who have symptoms of the virus. In France, again, anecdotally, I've heard of people my age, you know, younger millennials who have what appear to be symptoms, and really people beyond millennials, even older than that, people who have symptoms but who don't have serious respiratory issues or the most severe symptoms, essentially being told, you know what, stay at home, take it easy, but don't bother. We're not going to bother sending an ambulance, or don't come to the hospital because we need to conserve the resources we have. So I think those kinds of calculations are taking place in France, like they are in the United States. And, you know, the frightening thing is here, like the U.S., we're really at the beginning of this curve, maybe a little bit further along than the U.S. is, but just behind Italy. France is still at the beginning of this virus, at the beginning of the overloading of hospitals that seems almost inevitable, estimated to probably the peak of this will probably be coming in late April, early May from what we've heard. So, it's the beginning of a difficult process.
Now, we're talking about healthcare here. France does have, as you write in this Washington Post piece, France has a national public health system. So does that mean that anyone who needs it will get free healthcare?
Yeah, it means that the costs of healthcare are much, much lower than the United States, and close to free. And so again, I think that one of the big differences from what I can make with the United States is, in addition to the testing question, the actual question of treatment, treatment for this in France is at a much lower rate than it would be in the United States, like it would be for other serious illnesses that you can have in France, whether it's cancer or, you know, even common medical practices, surgeries, pregnancies in France. The rates are obviously a lot lower than the United States.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Cole Stengler. He's a Paris-based writer, and he wrote a piece in the Washington Post called "The Pandemic Has Flipped the Logic of Macronism on Its Head." And we are going to be speaking with Cole for the next 10 or so minutes, and then we will talk about the U.S. economy and what sort of relief will be coming for U.S. workers. If you have any questions for Cole about what is happening in France, or you'd like to share a story about what you're hearing from friends and family in Europe, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Over 170 million people are now locked down across Europe following Italy and Spain. On Tuesday, France imposed a nationwide lockdown. Now, the difference between the shelter-in-place policy and a lockdown is that right now, California is under shelter in place. It's the only state in the country that has implemented this measure. It basically, state officials and local officials are asking us to stay home as much as possible and to only go out for food, go to the bank, take a walk. We all need fresh air. But limit that. And if you do go out for a walk, make sure you've got distance, 6 feet of distance between yourself and others. Now, what's happening in Europe is they actually have lockdowns. And we were just talking with Cole about citizens in France actually needing to print out a piece of paper. It's a form to let officials know why they are going out. I mean, it is that serious. The goal, of course, is to flatten the curve. So, Cole, a lot of people in the United States are already losing their jobs. And as you know, we just do not have a strong social safety net here. Your piece was really interesting because you write that after President Macron took office in 2017, he told a group of tech entrepreneurs that he wanted to make France a startup nation. He said France would be a business-friendly country, but it would also be one that thinks and moves like startups. He ushered in tax cuts for the very wealthy. He rolled back worker protections. As you say, he imposed tight limits on state spending, including public hospitals. We saw massive, massive protests, which you reported on over the last few months. And as you report, things changed very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning how quick it's been. And again, like I said before, kind of hard to believe this has all happened in a week. But indeed, yeah, the Emmanuel Macron really taking a political 180 here in the last week. France has unveiled this stimulus plan. It might actually do more stimulus. And really, one of the most remarkable things here beyond the policies, and I don't want to exaggerate this too much because we are in a very specific moment dealing with a crisis. But if you listen to the way that Macron was speaking last week, it's really sounded like one of his predecessors, maybe a socialist from the 1980s, François Mitterrand. Or even Chirac, who was much more, Jacques Chirac, who was a president in the 90s, was a much more a centrist president as opposed to Macron's really aggressive pro-business approach. Macron's rhetoric was really vaunting the French social model. He said that the health, that free healthcare and our welfare state, his welfare state, a phrase he doesn't usually use, are quote, precious resources, indispensable advantages when destiny strikes. So really draping himself in the rhetoric here of the French welfare state, to try to rally the population and to show that the state is ready to support people. And we've seen that happen in at least in part here with this big expansion of the temporary unemployment system. The French labor minister and then the prime minister as well have said that they don't want any layoffs to take place, so zero layoffs. And the way that they, it's unclear if that'll actually happen, but the way the government is hoping to ensure that is to use the temporary unemployment system. Essentially, they're boosting the amount of money they're giving to employers so that employers can then pay their workers to basically remain on staff and not go into layoffs. And so we've had a huge response from the government to try to keep workers on payroll. And, you know, the question here is, inevitable question is it going to be enough for the depth of this crisis that's looking to be absolutely massive, not just in the United States, but also in Europe. And maybe one last point on this kind of political calculus changing, not just in France, but on the European level. We've seen today, actually, the head of the EU Commission talking about actually putting exemptions on these famous rules in the EU that limit spending, that limit deficit spending. So the EU at the moment has these rules that require states to have budget deficits below 3% of GDP, public debt below 60% of GDP. The EU is saying that they're actually exempting or at least putting these rules on hold.
Wow. Who will these benefits benefit? Because here in the United States, a lot of people are gig workers, they're independent contractors. We just, in many cases, we just don't have protections from our employers. And if you're driving for Uber and Lyft, for Instacart, we just did a show about this a couple of days ago. And I know that, you know, gig work is really expanding around the world. So how will gig workers and independent contractors be affected by these changes in France?
You know, it's a very good question. There's the French unemployment system is more generous than the U.S. system. It's larger, and so you have the ability to get various subsidies from the government through either the unemployment system, and also there's a minimum revenue system where you can get essentially state aid if your income is below a certain level. So that will be helping some independent contractors.
You also have a more generous paid time off policy than the United States.
Absolutely. You have a lot of employees here across the country taking advantage of those rules and their paid leave time. You also have another right that exists in France that does not exist in the United States, which is the right. It's essentially it could be translated as the right of withdrawal. It's the right to withdraw oneself from dangerous working conditions, conditions that pose a threat to one's health and safety. And so, of course, employers in France, also like the United States, push back on workers when they try to exert their rights. Of course, that happens. So I don't want to pretend like every worker in France can use this right. It's a very real battle that's taking place right now. But you have employees that have the ability at least to assert this right to withdraw themselves from unsafe conditions. And I think that's something that we're going to see taking place a lot. You know, one of the huge sectors here where workers are still showing up on the job, and of course it's extremely dangerous and difficult to do, is people working in supermarkets where people are going to shop. And so we've already seen some talk of workers exerting their right to withdraw from unsafe working conditions. Also in the postal system too, where organized labor is a little bit stronger, there's talk of using this right as well. So I think that's really one thing to keep an eye on.
Cole, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I think we might be getting a delay. I just want to read another part of your piece. I think this is a really important point. You write, "For decades now, business elites and many of the country's political parties have claimed that the French state's role in the economy is an obstacle to progress in an increasingly competitive and globalized marketplace. But today, France's relatively generous welfare state and the state's broad authority to enact pressure on employers appears far more like advantages than deficiencies, as signs of modernity, not outdatedness. The sort of bare bones protections offered in countries such as the United States suddenly look antiquated by comparison."
Right. You know, I think there's this kind of cliche that exists in France, also exists abroad, that somehow the country is backwards because the state is so big and provides workers all these protections, that somehow is really blocking the country from achieving its full potential. I think one example of this, you know, it's a common refrain we've heard from elites in France, who, by the way, there's no shortage of rich people in France like there is in the United States. But maybe one real distillation of this kind of cliche of France being backwards and stifled by big government, despite being the seventh largest economy in the world and having a robust private sector. Nevertheless, this cliche really came to life for me in a writer that perhaps your listeners have heard of in the New York Times, Bret Stephens, who wrote this column back in December when the pension reform battle ignited in France, about basically talking about how the U.S. should not want to become France because France's economy is so stifled and it's so backwards and et cetera. Okay. And I think what this crisis is really showing is, you know, maybe we should actually think the opposite. Maybe we should invert that logic. If you're a regular person in France, if you're working a service sector job, let's say at a fast food place in France, if you're working as a warehouse worker in France, you have much better access to healthcare right now to get to under this pandemic than you would in the United States. You don't have to worry about your bills piling up, about going bankrupt because of basic medical care. It's a really simple point. And again, I don't want to romanticize things in France too much, because there obviously are all kinds of problems here. As I was mentioning earlier, there's all kinds of labor tensions as well and employers do push back, but on a really fundamental, basic level, you have these advantages in the French system that you don't in the United States. You have access to free universal healthcare. You have national collective bargaining, unions negotiating contracts on a national level to protect you. These are really simple things, and I think it makes a difference for workers in France. And so, you know, it's something that I think hopefully will provoke some self-reflection here once this crisis subsides.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot because we are seeing some big legislative changes here in the United States that took just days to pass. And a lot of it has to do with exactly what you're talking about, evictions, moratoriums on evictions, and I'm sure we're going to see major changes in the coming weeks. Cole, thank you so much for joining us, and we will be thinking about you on all of France and all of Europe. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cole Stengler is a Paris-based writer. You can find his latest Washington Post piece called "The Pandemic Has Flipped the Logic of Macronism on Its Head." We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about the economic impacts here in the United States. And we're joined by Kevin Hall, national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, welcome back. It's great to talk with you.
Great to be back. Not under great circumstances, but great to be back.
Well, no, not at all. Kevin, I'm just wondering, I mean, this is all affecting us as reporters, and you've been coming on this show for many, many years. How are you doing right now?
Well, we're all working from home and trying to, like everyone else, you know, you guys just said on the break, we're humans in addition to reporters, so we have, in my case, a kid back from college having to do distance learning for the rest of the semester, and another kid whose high school is canceled for the indefinite future. So it makes for an interesting time, everybody being in the home. It also makes you hug people a little tighter. The nice side of that.
That's definitely for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kevin. Before we dive in and talk about economics and relief, Kevin, I just want to share a few pieces of breaking news, and I wonder if you have any to share. We just got word this morning that Americans will have an additional 3 months to file and pay their taxes. There was a recent announcement that the White House was deferring taxes, but Americans would still need to file by April 15th. Well, that has changed. You can now wait until July 15th to file. So that's really important. The other thing that I really wanted to talk about just briefly, Kevin, is there's new information out about how younger adults are not immune from the coronavirus. The New York Times is out with a piece just recently, and it's called "Younger Adults Make Up a Big Portion of Coronavirus Hospitalizations in the United States." New CDC data shows that nearly 40% of patients sick enough to be hospitalized were aged 20 to 54. So I just wanted to bring this up because over the last 2 weeks, we've been hearing that young people are immune. Young people might have the symptoms but not know it. Well, now we are learning that young people are also getting sick. So it's important to share that information.
Yeah, no, it's quite important. I think this is such a novel situation, excuse me, that it doesn't really have a lot of comparison. So, you know, the first reports came out of France that they were seeing younger victims there in intensive care. I think one of the other new things that I saw is, at least from China, they're now reporting that men who required hospitalization died at a higher rate than women. For whatever reason, I don't know how much you can extrapolate from that. So the safest way to look at it is nobody but the family dog is immune and act accordingly.
Right. Well, we will definitely continue to talk about this. I think, as you said, this is novel. We're just getting brand new science almost every day, and we're going to stay on top of this and bring you the latest information. Kevin, I just wonder what your thoughts are about the conversation we just had with Cole Stengler in Paris, who wrote a piece about how Macron's policies to cut taxes and to minimize worker protections has been completely changed. He's done a 180. And we're finally having a conversation about how countries like France and other European countries have national health care, collective bargaining, paid time off, paid sick leave. I mean, these are basic protections that we just do not have in the United States and we so desperately need right now.
Yeah, I mean, you don't hear anything about Norway and Sweden in the news, and I suspect it's because things are probably pretty good there. There are trade-offs in everything. If you go to a system where you have, you know, Medicare for all, there are some trade-offs. Some people claim that you lose innovation. The Germans have a pretty robust government hand in healthcare and still have a lot of innovation. So, you know, it's not one size fits all. But I think at the end of this, I think we're going to look. One of the things I feel certain about is the income inequality issue that's kind of been bubbling under the surface in this country for quite some time is really going to be shown in this crisis, because the people who are out of work the fastest, the people who can't get to the unemployment office to file for unemployment, you're going to see kind of this gulf between the haves and the have-nots that I think is going to lay this bare in a way that we kind of intuitively know but kind of kid ourselves, and I think it's going to become much more clear at the end of this crisis.
Can you give us any insights, Kevin, about the seriousness of this? A new study just came out from Survey USA, and this just came out yesterday at 7 o'clock p.m. last night at 7, and they found that 9% of working people in the United States have been laid off so far. That is 14 million people.
Oh yeah, it's going to be the numbers are going to be astronomical, and I think that's why you see Congress moving. They claim at breakneck pace. It doesn't feel like breakneck, but you know, Congress moving to find ways to directly get money into people's hands. I think the initial thought was to get people at least enough money to pay their bills. But you know, we've all seen these stories for years about people living paycheck to paycheck, right?
Exactly.
You know, 3 weeks before they get any of this money, how are people surviving? We see it in all our communities where this is being felt. And yeah, there's the Goldman Sachs, I think, put out an estimate this week that just this week alone there'll be 2.5 million new unemployment claims. So there's a much greater number of people who are thrown out of work, but those who are actually filing for unemployment insurance claims, they're anticipating about 2.5 million, which is a number we haven't ever seen in a week.
Wow.
You know, it's just going to, the next 3 weeks after that are going to look just like that. So this is kind of like a meteor hitting Earth type thing, like you see in the movies. I mean, when you think of 2008 or you think of the 1987 stock market turmoil, you had kind of an incident that created in 2008. We had from August till February, you had this long stretch where you had a series of things happening. This is every sector of the economy all at once kind of going off the cliff together and just a screeching halt because of the forced isolation of all economic activity. So there's not really anybody that's kind of a safe haven or spared. Some are a little bit better. Moody's put out a report today about some, you know, what sectors are likely to fare better, and I jotted some notes knowing I was coming on with you guys. And you know, things like IT, construction, telecom, there are some sectors that will be less hurt. But across the board, if you can't spend money in the economy, what good is giving someone $1,000 if you can't leave your house to spend it? Where are you going to spend it? Ostensibly, it will go to paying your bills, I guess.
Right. The other thing, Kevin, is this is affecting people at all levels. I was talking to my dad last night, and he said so many people on social media, a lot of his friends, are saying, I don't know if I'm going to pay my bills. These are people who are hairdressers, people who work in construction. I mean, people, you know, middle class people are very concerned because they're not going to be able, they don't know how they're going to pay their bills. So this is affecting people really across the board. A lot of people in the middle are going to be affected by this.
Yeah, and here's something that people haven't fully processed, and you're starting to see it dawn on people now. So one of the things they're debating in Congress is, well, we don't want to give this money to companies who can keep it for themselves. Mm. We want to have it routed so that employees can get it directly. Well, you know, they'll have to go to a bank maybe and present a tax form. That's one idea that's being floated. You know, you see, first you'd have to have your last year tax forms, which is, you know, some people are more organized than others. But then on top of that, branch banks all around the country have been closing, have been consolidating and pushing people to online banking. So, you know, how do you physically go get this government payment if you can't even find a bank near you? I live in a rural area. The nearest bank to me is 25 miles away. And I think I'm not going to get a payment anyway, but you get what I'm saying, that there are all these technological changes that we were suddenly facing in addition to how you get money to people. And then, you know, people are going to make those choices, who gets paid, who doesn't. I did a story on a restaurant in Miami yesterday where the guy is trying to throw work to his, he's trying to do as much as he can at this Italian restaurant to, he's got 8 employees, rotate them, give them a little income, but he's got to make the decision, if they offer me a loan instead of a direct payment, I still have to pay it back, and there's no evidence that this is going to get better quickly. Why would I take a loan out versus just closing? And I think that's a lot of small businesses are going to make that. In the two competing visions in the Senate right now, the McConnell bill is much more focused on corporate America and larger companies. The Schumer bill is focused on smaller companies. Neither of them are offering what experts who've gone through this before. There's a very interesting paper out by two conservative economists, Glenn Hubbard, who had been in the Bush administration, and Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute, and they estimate that 1.2 trillion is what is needed to help small businesses. They define those 500 and fewer employees. Right now, the Schumer bill calls about 300 billion. So that's roughly, you know, they're calling for 4 times as much as what the Democrats are asking for. And their thinking is that small business is the catalyst, is where real people live and work, and that's where you should be focused. And then on the other side of the equation, you've got Boeing, you know, which has lost 64% of its value since the beginning of the year in share price, which is pretty stunning. And Boeing isn't just a company. It's involved in a lot of national security issues. So across the board, this is really, really complex.
Wow. Today we're speaking with Kevin Hall, national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, longtime reporter. If you have any questions about economic relief, please email us. We're understaffed at our studio at KALW, so the best way to contact us is to email us yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. And I know that some of you do not use the computer, and so we're going to put our heads together over the weekend and figure out how we can still hear from those of you who call in. But we're just understaffed at the studio because we want to keep everyone safe. So for now, please email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Kevin, there are so many moving parts to the bills at the federal level. State and local governments are also working really hard to let people know how they can apply for some kind of financial relief. At the end of the day, I mean, we can talk about the politics, and we'll eventually do that to talk about what happened here with the testing, with the bills, the special interests. But right now, I just want to let people know, how and when will they receive relief? So based on your read of these federal bills, what can people expect?
Boy, that's actually a tough question because the earliest something is going to happen, you know, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, has asked Congress to have a package passed by Monday. McConnell has just come out with the Republican package. There has certainly not been the rancor that you see with a lot of other stuff, but that said, there's still two very different views of who you help first. And so in a best case scenario, something gets done Monday, then, you know, how quickly can that get out to the communities? That's the big question, because again, as we were highlighting earlier, with, you know, do you do it through a bank? How do you actually pay people? How do people get a check? Do they get it from the IRS, the same kind of mechanism that the IRS? If you've e-filed, does the IRS send it to you? I haven't seen anything definitive on that, and I'm not sure how that kind of aid is going to flow. And then on the unemployment insurance is handled on the state level, so there's a couple of questions there. Can you physically get to an unemployment office? Can you do it online? What sort of waivers? They require proof that you're looking for a job that presumably is going to be waived at this point. But you know, how quickly can all that happen? I would guess the best case scenario is at least 2 weeks from the following Monday.
Wow.
So think of people paycheck to paycheck who were laid off last week. They're going almost a month. So that it's, you know, I think food banks, United Way, people like that are all kind of gearing up, but all hampered again by the kind of the lodge at home, stay at home type orders as well. So it's complicated.
And Kevin, in the Republican-led bill, we're reading that that plan includes $1,000 per person and $500 per child, and that would go directly to people. Do you have any updates on that?
Well, $1,200 per person and another $500 per child, but it's also capped. So it starts, I think, at $50,000 or a little bit higher. It starts changing, and then it doesn't go to anybody who makes more than $99,000. Now, that's interesting given the incredibly high cost of living in your part of the country.
Right.
So I don't know if that will survive or if that's going to change. I had seen some other versions of the loans that are going to be available for small businesses up to $10 million interest-free. That's one of the proposals that would be in the Senate. That is up to individuals who earn as much as $499,000. So that hypothetically could come down if there's pushback from Democrats. So all that's going to get thrashed out over the weekend. But, you know, I would guess that in New York and in San Francisco in particular, those two communities, $99,000 is not a high salary as it is in much of the rest of the country.
Well, exactly. And if you're making $99,000 and you lost your job, you might have a lot of student debt and you might not have much in the bank.
Well, there's good news on the student debt front. They apparently first floated the idea of waiving interest payments, and now apparently they've got a two-month, they're calling now for a two-month freeze on payments, not just interest. So I've seen kind of mixed reporting on what that's going to entail, but it looks like they're moving towards a two-month freeze, at least on student loan payments. So that's going to freeze up, and I think there's been a call for any mortgage that's held at Fannie and Freddie, you know, the two quasi-government agencies that buy mortgages from the banks so that banks don't have to keep that debt on their books. Those government entities, quasi-government entities, are likely at the end of this to also start doing a moratorium like 2 months no payment, or at least if you need to hold off for X amount of time. That's very different than what we had during the housing crisis in 2008, where, in fact, banks did help you restructure, but it was already counting against your credit, and there were all these other things going on. So I think this time it's going to be cleaner, but that may be a relief. So I mean, the good news is they're looking at every possible way to help families and individuals, particularly in the lower to middle income stratus, have some sort of bridge, because the thinking, and I'm not sure I completely agree with it, but the thinking is that this is a temporary event. It will pass through like a wave, and then everything kind of snap back to normal and perhaps go the other direction. But what I fear is I don't think we fully understand, just as we didn't in 2008 with financial markets, how much things are interconnected, right? If you go out of business, a company goes out of business, the insurance companies that underwrote lines for those businesses go out, the suppliers, it has a cascading effect that you just don't kind of pick yourself off the floor and go back to normal. So I do think there's going to be a longer tail to this than I think we realize at this point.
And Kevin, what are you hearing from politicians? Because what's happening right now is that you're getting legislation in different states, mostly California and New York. New York just announced that they're going to put a 30-day moratorium on student loans and medical debt for people. And what I fear is that we're going to see this kind of legislation in states that are run by Democrats. And I'm concerned about people who live in states where their politicians do not take action. And that's why we need federal legislation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the famous saying attributed to Warren Buffett that I don't know if it was really his or it just attributed to him, but, you know, when the tide goes out, you can see it swimming it without trunks. And I think you're going to see here over time which states you know, were supportive of their citizens and which weren't. And it's hard to, in this environment, it's hard to think that far ahead to see whether we're going to get federal legislation. But it's also pretty easy to see how this is likely to become, you know, these are going to become central issues of a campaign in just a number of months, because what are we now, in March, you know, come September, October, we're going to really feel these inequities in ways that are really apparent. And I think that's going to really crystallize, you know, the debate over what kind of programs we need. So it's going to be, it's going to be a very complicated political environment, separate from the economic environment going forward. We can hope, all we can do is hope that it will lead to greater bipartisanship. How about leave it on a hopeful note like that?
Well, Kevin, final question for you. You said that it could be 2 weeks until people see relief. I don't want to leave on a negative note, but why is it taking so long given that people need to pay their bills now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, I think there's been debate over where giving money directly to consumers. The idea first came up with Jason Furman, who had been President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors chair. It was quickly seconded by Greg Mankiw, who was an official in the Bush administration. You had kind of prominent economists calling for it. Steven Mnuchin quickly embraced it. Great idea. And then, you know, that's something that could have been done separate from this whole package. It does feel that that things are moving a bit slow. And I think part of it is this question of how do you pay for this? And they don't want to talk about how you pay for this, but it must be part of the discussion in the background. And we've had tax cuts, which have left us with a huge deficit at a time when that number should have been falling in an economy with 3.5% unemployment. And so we've started this in a hole. And I think if there's anything I would hope your listeners come away with is that, you know, after the financial crisis of 2008, both Democrats and later Republicans did nothing to knock down these debt levels and acted under the assumption that markets aren't going to punish them for carrying high levels of debt. And so we enter this, you know, with very little wiggle room without running up just astronomical debt like we've never had. This will end up more debt than we had in World War II. I'm pretty confident of that.
And well, Kevin,
how do you pay for it?
Exactly. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we would love to have you back. Take care. We're thinking of you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for all the great work you guys are doing in your community.
Thank you. You too. Kevin Hall is a national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You can find information about what we discussed about relief at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.